Heads up! Government-guaranteed safe food is on the way. Get hungry for brightly packaged meals manufactured from genetically engineered soybeans, fortified with Chinese-made vitamins, flavored with nano-goo of choice, sterilized with spent nuclear fuels, and of course, colored green for sensitivity. Wait, don't run away. Stick with me, and we'll ask, who is government safe food going to make safe? Them or us?
Welcome to the award-winning Food Chain Show with your host, Michael Olson. Now, get ready for an hour of What's Eating What Radio.
Well, hello out there. You are tuned into the 679th edition of the Food Chain right here on News Talk Radio. Or hey, perhaps you're among our friends over there in Wakana who are tuned in as we stream along on the radio page at MantroFarm.com. But wherever you are and wherever you are, welcome aboard. I am Michael Olson, your host for this hour of What's Eating What Radio, with engineer Nikki James on the boards. Hello, Nikki.
Hello.
Producer Carol Stafford on the phones.
Hello there.
Folks, the pattern holds true. First, take a problem and grow it into a disaster. Second, develop a fix that protects your friends and gives you more control over your enemies. Third, frighten the masses into buying the fix, lest their lives all fall into ruin. Now, Senator Dick Durbin of Illinois loves us and cares for us and wants only to see the best for us. So when a few of our neighbors were sickened by contaminated peanut butter and others tainted by tainted spinach, he proposed the federal government take total control of the nation's food chain in order to guarantee safe food for all. But as a career politician out of East St. Louis, Senator Dick Durbin does not really know how to make all the nation's food safe. So he has enlisted help from campaign contributors in the food industry and had them draft rules and regulations that will guarantee safe food for all. After much wringing of hands and demonstrations of angst, industry professionals drafted food safety rules and regulations so onerous and expensive that only those with sufficient economies of scale can afford to comply. Now, what are those economies of scale? Well, if I have 1 acre and wish to buy a politician's vote for $10,000, that vote will cost me $10,000. But if you have 10,000 acres and wish to buy that politician's vote, you can spread the costs across those 10,000 acres, which means the vote will only cost you $1. And so what that means for all of us is that we have a future filled with government-guaranteed safe food to look forward to. And we'll just have to hang around and wait for our mouths to water in anticipation of the brightly packaged meals manufactured from genetically engineered soybeans, fortified with Chinese-made vitamins, flavored with nano-grade goo of choice, sterilized with spent nuclear fuel, and, of course, colored green for sensitivity. But, you know, our mouths really do not water for the at the thought of that kind of government-safe food. And so today we ask, who is government-safe food going to make safe, them or us? And boy, do we have some people that can help us out today. We'll start with Mark Castell, who is with the Cornucopia Institute. Mark, welcome back to the Food Chain. Pleasure to have you. Let's see. Are you there? Hello, Mark.
No problem on my end.
There you go. Michael. Welcome back. I guess we last had you on show number 507. We talked about greenwashed milk. And folks, I'd like to say, give a big pat on the back to the folks at the Cornucopia Institute, because of all of the organizations that I track around the United States, Cornucopia is one that really has been watching over the organic industry and trying their best to make certain that when you buy something organic, it actually holds true to the spirit of what organic is supposed to be. I noticed that when the giant dairy started, you know, producing organic milk with, you know, big giant herds of tens of thousands of cattle crammed into these confinement facilities, and, you know, they'd walk through once a day with a picture of an organic pasture, and then they'd call it their milk organic. It was the folks at Cornucopia Institute that stood up and said, you can't do this. So a big attaboy to all you folks, Mark, for a job well done in that regard.
Thank you very much. And the interesting dovetail here
the poignant dovetail is that we're talking about food safety, and consumers in mass have been voting for a different kind of food safety protocol. They've been voting in the marketplace for organic food and for locally produced food, direct marketed food, farmers markets, CSAs. So they've made their choice very, very clear. Now it's our job together, all of us, to protect that option and make sure that this food safety juggernaut doesn't put out of business literally the safest food producers
right.
in our country.
So that's why we're here today, and a pleasure to have you aboard with us to help out. Also with us today, we've got Fran Shaw. Fran, welcome to the food chain.
Thank you, Michael.
And you know, a former tax attorney.
Yes, I am.
That's pretty good. And you're with us from Cleveland today.
Yes.
Is it true that Cleveland rocks?
Cleveland rocks.
Okay, good enough. How did you become fascinated? The reason that I invited you today is that somebody sent me an action letter that you sent out that had a real precise call to action with respect to the food safety legislation working its way through Congress, and essentially...
Oh, you got my letter on 510. Okay.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
How did I become interested? Last fall. I'm pretty new at this, actually. Last fall, I saw the movie Fresh, and it was like an epiphany. You know, watching the part about Joel Salatin's polyphase farm and realizing that food really could be grown sustainably and animals really could be happy and healthy and grass-fed and the environment could be sustained, and it was very exciting for me. And I started devouring books. I went to Michael Pollan's books, of course, like The Omnivore's Dilemma, and moved from there into documentary films and a whole stack of books, and recognized that Cleveland, Ohio has a very active local and growing local foods movement. We have a lot of local farmers and a lot of people who want to start local farms. And for whatever reason, I mean, I think partly they're just busy and focused on something else, they aren't necessarily all that tuned into what is going on or may be coming up on the regulatory front.
Right.
And I found myself being very drawn to it, so I jumped in.
So you're the one that's following the parade saying the emperor has no clothes?
Yeah, essentially. I mean, yeah, and I believe that if I could have been so ignorant, I'm pretty educated and aware, and I've been organic forever. And if I could have been as ignorant as I was about the whole food situation and could be so, you know, readily persuaded and would change so many of my eating habits, that there must be many others similarly situated.
Okay.
Who, you know, hearing a little truth would change.
Well, we'll see if we can bring some light to the situation. We thank you for joining us on the food chain today. Also with us today, we have Judith McCrary. Judith is calling in from, where are you, Judith?
Texas,
good. And you're with an organization I joined in a minute without knowing the first thing about it. It's called Farm and Ranch Freedom Alliance. Well, whatever you are, sign me up.
Well, you know, it's fun listening who's on this show. I think it's going to be a lot of fun to be on with your other guests as well. I'm also an attorney, but I left my legal practice 5 years ago to found Farm and Ranch Freedom Alliance.
Uh-huh.
Because I came to the realization of what was going on in the food supply, and my husband and I actually have a farm, so I actually get dirt under my fingers on a regular basis, you know, handling animals, you know, doing compost, and realize that the regulations are being made by people who don't have the first clue
right.
of what it means, what the good food movement means.
Hey, Mark, are you an attorney too?
No, but I have a PhD from TSC. I tell folks I got my PS post-hole digger from Tractor Supply Corporation.
Good enough. Well, I'm a former
lobbyist, but I don't have a law degree.
Well, good. Well, then we're here to talk about essentially a piece of legislation, and so we have a couple attorneys and a lobbyist. So maybe you guys can really help us here. First of all, let me ask all three of you: do we really need the government to take charge of our food chain, Mark?
Well, I'd say yes, because we really have two food chains. And one, as you've illustrated in your promo, is poisoning our citizenry. We've shifted from a farming and agrarian-based society where we basically grew food locally or regionally, processed that food locally or regionally, to a centralized industrialized system. So if we have one packing shed that produces conventional and organic spinach for a dozen or more different name brands. And then we shipped that from that one facility that received spinach from numerous farms, from numerous fields in Mexico and California. And then we shipped those to all 50 states in the United States. We're really asking for a problem. And we do need that oversight, because obviously the protocols in place aren't protecting our people. On the other hand, if we create...
Hold the other hand. We're going to have to take a quick break, and we'll also pick up Judith and Francis on this same question. Folks, this is the Food Chain. Michael Olson here. Today, we're talking about government-guaranteed safe food. Is the government out to protect us or them? What do you think? 800-624-2665, 831-479-1080. Right back.
Get this. The average acre of farmland in or near the city limits may earn in excess of $123,000 per year. To learn how so much can be earned from so little, pick up a copy of Metro Farm, the guide to growing for big profit on a small parcel of land. Metro Farm is the PMA Ben Franklin Book of the Year Award winner by Michael Olson that contains over 500 pages of photos, charts, checklists, illustrations, and in-depth interviews. Metro Farm will teach you how to develop a strategy, survey markets, select crops, organize business, establish production, prepare for market, and make the sale. Metro Farm will teach you how others just like you earn a good living by growing high-value specialty crops for people who are truly appreciative. Abraham Lincoln said, "The greatest fine art of the future will be the making of a comfortable living from a small parcel of land." Get in on that future today. Pick up a copy of Metro Farm at bookstores, lawn and garden supply stores, 1-800-624-BOOK, or at www.metrofarm.com.
Well, do we need the government to take total control of the food chain to ensure our food safety? Well, yes, of course we do, Mark Costello says from the Cornucopia Institute, because where we have one facility that feeds people all over the country, we have little or no control. I guess that falls under Michael Olson's second law of the food chain, which is the farther you go from the source of your food, the less control you have over what's in that food. And so we do need the government to watch over that industrial food chain. But on the other hand, Mark?
But on the other hand, Michael, if we promulgate legislation in Congress or regulations at the FDA and USDA that we all, your guests today, would describe as, quote, one size fits all, we will create such an onerous burden and economic handicap that will either force the local, sustainable, safe farmers out of business, or will make them less competitive by disproportionately kind of coming up with regressive taxes or fee systems or testing protocols that really make them much less competitive. Either way, the farmers lose, and the people who are seeking out this authentically safer food are going to lose too.
Fran, does that make sense to you?
It makes sense to me, and I more or less agree with Mark. I agree that certainly in the there are two food chains, that the local food chain is the most. Are you there still?
Yeah, still here.
We have direct traceability. We tend to know the farmers. They eat the same stuff that we do. That's a completely separate food chain than industrial agriculture. I think I have a somewhat different attitude than Mark does about the question of whether we need the government to take charge. I mean, I know that's been a standard kind of approach, and it has a lot going for it. However, the problems we continuously encounter repeatedly is that those who are supposed to be regulated in the name of the public health wind up controlling the regulators, whether it's the FDA, the USDA, where, you know, we have example after example of the, you know, bench-level career scientists saying one thing.
Well, Fran, it pretty much has to work that way, right? Because, you know, yeah. I use the example of Senator Dick Durbin, a nice guy and all. He loves us dearly. But essentially, he's a career politician out of East St. Louis, and he doesn't know anything about food safety. So who does he turn to tell him about food safety? Well, he turns to those people who have donated liberally to his election campaign. What do I do here, he says. And they come up with the rules. And so it turns out that the people who are supposed to be regulated and watched over have set up the rules to be watched over, right?
Yeah, you have the fox watching the foxes or the hen house. Yeah, and I think, I mean, there is an understandable reason. They do look to the, quote, experts. They do not have the expertise. But, as you say, it's not as laudable as that or as clean as that. There is actually a lot of, it doesn't always smell very good when you start looking at these things.
Okay. Let's go to Judy. Judy, I have a friend out there in the Shenandoah River Valley of Virginia. His name's Joel Salatin, and he's a, boy, when it comes to preaching agriculture, he's really a heretic, and he came out with the most frightening thing I've ever heard anybody say. He said that small farmers who sell directly to customers should have no government regulations whatsoever.
I think there's a whole range of opinions, and Joel's very much the libertarian voice in the sustainable ag movement, an incredibly strong one. I think you don't even have to go that far. I think there's a lot of folks, and for instance, myself included, who think, you know, local regulation might be a decent thing. There are advantages to some sort of regulation, and at the local level, there's a likelihood that the government will be responsive. You know, at the local level, these regulators have to deal with the people they're regulating mm-hmm. on a daily basis. You know, it's part of their community.
Which, when it comes to food, that's the way it should be.
That's the way it should be.
Right.
And frankly, that system has worked pretty mm-hmm. well. There are problems with it, and I absolutely agree with Joel. There are times that we see overregulation at the state and local level, too. But overall, from at least a safety standpoint, what we've seen is you don't see outbreaks of foodborne illness in the local food system. They're tiny if they happen at all.
Well, I interviewed a lawyer who sues food companies that sell bad food, you know, and they make people sick. So he sues them. And I asked him that if he ever run across an instance in which local, you know, people get sick from local food. And he hasn't in what, 30 years of practice or something incredible like that. It's just he's never seen it. Or perhaps if he has seen it, he's figured out that he can't make any money, you know, at it one way or another. But it seems to me like if you make bad food and you sell it to your neighbors and they get sick, well, you know, that situation is going to get corrected very fast.
Exactly. And actually, step one is, you know, farmers like myself, like the other people in the local food system, the first people who eat that food are us. You know, it's the farmer,
right.
his family eating the food before it ever gets to the customer. So the odds are that food, pretty overwhelmingly, that food's safe before it ever hits the customer. And if something did happen, it's on such a small scale, it's immediately trackable. Not very many people get sick. It gets cleaned up immediately. It's not a problem. And that's not what federal regulation's for. Federal regulation is supposed to be when you can't deal with things at a local or state level.
Right. Where somebody is selling you organic spinach from China, for example. Well, how organic is it? Who's watching over that? You have very little control over that. Mark, let me ask you this. What danger do we see for small-scale agriculture in the food safety legislation working its way through Congress?
Well, really, there's a couple kind of macro points here. One is cost. And although we see this congressional push, there are also simultaneous efforts in at the regulatory agencies, the Food and Drug Administration and the Department of Agriculture. So one could be as simple as a fee structure that would be regressive. So in one example, $500 fee regardless of the size. So if you're a small farmer producing berries and you make them into jams and jellies and you go to farmers markets for a few weeks during the summer, that could really make it impractical. The other are a set of record keeping, HACCP requirements, and testing regimes. That for, again, your example of somebody who's doing 10,000 acres, if you have a spinach crop and you're going to put it in a bag and you've got 150-acre fields and you might get a couple crops a year, the amount to test that isn't going to be too burdensome. On the other hand, if you're a CSA grower or you go to a farmer's market locally and you harvest certain leafy greens every single week, that could be a tremendous burden. And if you're a husband and wife operation, maybe your kids help, maybe you have one or two hired staff people, your burden is a lot different than if you're a major corporate scale industrial operator that might already have a testing laboratory in-house and a full-time quality control staff person. So we're really making it very hard for family-scale agriculture, local agriculture to compete. And that's why, before we get too far, and I'll let maybe Judith chime in, we should tell your listeners about the amendment, at least one of them, that's...
From John Tester?
Right, from Senator Tester from Montana, who happens to be a certified organic farmer himself. But maybe I'll let Judith chime in with the current status of that, because a vote's coming up, and we can all make our voices heard for the kind of fairness that we hope will be embodied in this legislation.
Well, we'll pick up that amendment here pretty quick. We're going to have to take a quick break because that's the way that our commercial radio works. This is The Food Chain. I am Michael Olson. Today we're talking about the government's effort to guarantee you and I safe food. So how does the government do that? Well, the government really doesn't know anything about safe food, so they ask others to develop the rules and regulations. Well, who do they ask? They ask the friends that have put them where they are today. So those who are very big and grow a lot and produce a lot have a lot of say in how to make perfectly safe food. And one of the ways to do that is to get rid of the little guy. And that seems to be what's going on with food safety legislation, but might not be. We'll pick it up when we come back with Mark Castell with the Cornucopia Institute, Fran Shaw out there in Cleveland, and Judith McGeary down in Texas, right back. Well, someone who may have been Ben Franklin said, "Those who are willing to trade freedom for security deserve neither." Well, folks, we appear to be willing to trade our food freedom for our food security or food safety. And so we're allowing our government to pass food safety legislation that's going to really change the nature of our food chain. So get ready for brightly packaged meals manufactured from genetically engineered soybeans, fortified with Chinese-made vitamins, flavored with nano gray goo of choice, sterilized with spent nuclear fuel, and, of course, colored green for sensitivity. But, gee, it just doesn't sound good to me. So we're asking today, just who is this food safety legislation designed to make safe, them or us? And with us today, Mark Castell, the Cornucopia Institute, Judy McGeary, who is with Farm and Ranch Freedom Alliance, and Fran Shaw out there in Cleveland. We got a couple attorneys and a former lobbyist, so we're geared to look into this government legislation. Mark made the comment that if the food safety legislation is going to be so expensive that only the biggest of the big will be able to comply with it. But I heard other complaints as well. I heard from a farmer in New Hampshire, I believe it was, who was talking about if they make us comply with the leafy green requirements that they're in this legislation, we'll have to clean the entire woods of animals. We'll have to sterilize our complete garden. There won't be any place left to grow things. So let's talk a little bit about some of the technologies involved in this. Fran, did that complaint ring true to you?
It does ring true, although and maybe Judith will know more than I do about this, but my understanding of the most recent version of 510 is it may go through to the Managers Committee. It would include an amendment from Barbara Boxer, which would take out all of the rules on animal encroachment.
Mm-hmm.
So there's that. The whole deal on animal, as you've mentioned, we're not only talking about what we're looking at under Senate 510, though. There's also this whole leafy greens movement that started in California. The USDA and the FDA are going around the country under the auspices of the so-called Produce Safety Project with the Pew Charitable Trust and the Georgetown University, doing what they call stakeholders discussion series in seven different cities. I went to the one in Columbus in March. And what struck me about this, I actually went to the breakout session on wildlife encroachment, was that even though the FDA and the USDA folks who were there seemed pretty eager to go ahead with regulations that look like that, you know, that are designed to sterilize the fields, there's no scientific basis. There are no studies that support it.
Fran, for those of us who don't know what we're talking about when we say animal encroachment, what are we talking about?
Well, Mark and Judith, back me up on this, please, but as I understand it, we're talking about something as simple as an animal walking on the field. So a squirrel jumping across the field, a deer strolling across the field, certainly the Amish or the Mennonites who use horses to pull their plows as opposed to motorized vehicles. That's
so
pretty basic.
So what we're saying is that animals won't be allowed on the field. Let's go to Judith and have her. I'm going to put Mark on hold here so he can hear.
Okay, let's go down. Judith, are you there?
Yes, I am.
Okay, animal encroachment.
You know, this is one of those incredibly messed up, confusing areas, and no one has a good answer. I can say what the bad answer is. The bad answer is what FDA has done so far, which is what was just being discussed. You aren't allowed to have animals crossing the field. If you do, you have to destroy the crops within a certain distance. They're applying it to all animals.
How does this apply to small-scale family organic farmers that, you know, that don't have a lot of room? What are they going to do?
That's a darn good question. Up till now, it hasn't applied to small-scale farmers. It's only applied to farmers selling into grocery store chains, because it was a marketing agreement. But under Senate 510, it would allow the FDA to promulgate these types of regulations on everyone growing crops. And, you know, there's language that's being put in right now requiring flexibility. Was just referred to, there's some discussion about trying to pull some of the language. I don't think it's actually saying FDA can't regulate based on animal encroachment. It's things along the lines of, well, FDA has to come up with a good scientific basis for which wildlife it regulates. You know, and that assumes that we trust FDA's science process, which has proven
Is this setting up a situation where government officials will have to be bribed?
Well, you know, yes. That's assuming small farmers could bribe them. I mean, the problem, what's going to happen, what would happen if this bill, I think, goes through the way it's written now, is they'll come up with regulations, there'll be a huge fight, there'll be some iffy language in it, and then it's going to become a question of who they choose to enforce on. You know, who do they spot?
That's what I'm saying, is that you'll have to be of the correct political party, or you'll have to bribe the right government official in order to comply with rules and regulations that are so complex that nobody can understand them or comply with them.
And it's also just not practical. To follow up on the example Mark was giving, you know, you've got the industrial farmers who grow maybe two or three crops, maybe, if that many. My favorite farm in Austin grows literally 100 different crops
a year. Right.
They can't keep up with all the different rules that are going to be passed. It's just not feasible. It's not possible for them.
So the rules have been established for industrial production of food. However, those rules also will apply, unless something happens, to local agriculture.
Exactly.
Which works on an entirely different situation. Okay, we're going to go quickly to the phones here. I'm going to put a couple of you on hold here, and we're going to go first to Bob. Bob, welcome to the food chain.
Yes, thank you. I should say I'm a livestock producer to start with, and I wanted to. It's a great show, and it should be many hours long. But I wanted your guests, especially lawyers, to comment on how when a small family farm becomes a food production facility premises, that the farmer and their family no longer have the constitutional rights, such as in the Fourth Amendment against unreasonable search and seizure.
You're saying that this food legislation allows for the government to search and seize on your property without...
At any time without going to a judge first to obtain a warrant or showing probable cause. And this has a serious bad effect on the quality of life. And a lot of small farmers aren't in it for the money. They're in it for the quality of life that affords them and their children.
Well, let's go to this and ask about the Constitution. What about the unreasonable search and seizure provisions? I guess we're going to have to take a quick break. But when we come back, Bob, we'll pick that up. Thanks for the call.
Okay, thank you.
Appreciate it.
Right. Yeah.
So, what about, I guess that's an element of the food safety legislation that we haven't even talked about yet, giving the government the right to go into your farm and examine your books and then look into your life without having a warrant. Why? Because you produce food for your neighbors. That's a serious breach of human activity that must be looked into, I guess. This is the Food Chain, Michael Olson. Today we're talking about government-guaranteed fresh food. Yum! We have with us today Mark Castell, the Cornucopia Institute. We have Judith McGeary, Farm and Ranch Freedom Alliance. Sign me up, Judith. And also Fran Schall from Cleveland. We have a couple attorneys, and we have a former lobbyist, and we have you. 800-624-2665, 831-479-1080. Right back. Well, just because I'm paranoid doesn't mean they're not out to get me. And I think they are out to get me to eat government-guaranteed safe food. Now, the notion of eating this government-guaranteed safe food simply does not raise my taste buds. It doesn't interest me. And furthermore, it frightens me to think of what is going to happen to our food chain if the government does what it must do to guarantee safe food. And one of the things it's going to have to do is get rid of all of life in the growing fields, because life is what makes things dirty. And the animal encroachment provisions being pitched as part of food safety is part of that. Mark Castell, Cornucopia Institute, it seems to me that getting rid of life in the growing fields is directly opposite of what organic agriculture is all about.
Well, Michael, they're not talking about the elephant, speaking of animals, in the room. You know, this whole concept of sterilizing the fields comes out of the spinach debacle a few years ago,
right,
where they surmised that it was wildlife that depositing feces in the field that causes contamination. Absolutely no testing that scientific proof that proved that. It was just a thesis. But let me talk to your listeners for a second about what we do know that introduces these dangerous, deadly pathogens into our environment and into our food system. And that's the industrial scale livestock productions, these factory mm-hmm. farms, feedlots that contaminate surface water and groundwater in our environment.
For miles
so somehow around. Spinach itself is not dangerous. Somehow you have to introduce fecal material, and not just any fecal material, but one that's been contaminated with one of these deadly pathogens. And whether that happens in the field, whether that happens from irrigation water that's contaminated, surface water, whether that happens in the packing shed, whether that happens from unsanitary worker management where they've been contaminated by eating this unhealthy meat. So one way or another, much of this traces back to our industrialized livestock production system.
Okay, then let me ask you this.
No one's talking about that.
Yes. Mark Castell, is it possible for the government to guarantee safe food?
Well, if we're talking about fresh food, the answer, I think, is obviously no, that we're living in, we want fresh food. One of the fears here, and one of the projects we've worked on with California farmers, is they've now required all, quote, raw almonds to
right.
either be pasteurized, and I use that word, quote, pasteurized, with a toxic fumigant, or heat, and still call them raw. So the next step here is that we'll irradiate all our food, mm-hmm. or treat them with some kind of fumigant or heat, and we really won't have fresh food. But we know that will diminish the nutritional value radically of we're eating.
Which is the only way you can have safe food, is to take all of the life out of it. Let's go to Mary. Mary, thank you for calling the Food Chain. Go ahead.
Hi, Michael. Thanks for the show. I want to know, for your guests, if there is a possibility to work into this bill an exemption for consumers. In other words, if I, the consumer, don't want the U.S. government telling me what to eat, and I really don't, then can I go to my local farmer's market, local farmer, sign a release, and that I will take my own risk with my own decision of what to eat? And I just think the U.S. government needs to get out of our lives and stop adding more reasons for taxes to go up and another layer of bureaucracy. And I'll take my answer off the air.
Okay, well, I guess you kind of given us an inroads to start talking about Senator John Tester's amendment to the food safety legislation. Let's see. Let's go to Fran. Fran, do you want to pick that up? Senator John Tester's amendment?
Oh, let's see if I even have the details on what Tester's amendment would do. I think one of the key things that it would do would be to exempt farmers who have, what is it, at least half of their sales directly to consumers or directly to farmers' markets or to restaurants. So that, from the record-keeping requirements.
Mm-hmm.
And Judith or Mark could jump in if I have that wrong.
Judith?
Yes.
We've got, and I love the way the caller put it. That was a fabulous way of approaching it. There are two Tester amendments. One would exempt what Fran was just talking about. There's a direct farm-to-consumer exemption, where if the farmer sells more than half of the produce directly to consumers, restaurants, hotels, you know, farm-to-school programs, you know, direct to end users, they're exempt from the produce standards, what we were just talking about, where
okay.
FDA would tell you how to grow things. The second amendment is from these record-keeping requirements, the hazard analysis, the red tape side of things.
Mm-hmm.
And the Tester amendment there would exempt any facility that grosses under $500,000 from those record-keeping and red tape requirements. And, you know, these are great amendments. They really support people who are selling directly to consumers, small-scale startups. I realize $500,000 sounds like a lot, but when you
but
look
not,
at what
yeah.
what they net, it's a very small business.
Yes. Is that gross or net was going to be my question.
The $500,000 is gross.
Ooh, so
gross
that's
income.
Not very big at all. We're talking
no.
very small.
So, yeah, I mean, these are the people. These are the jam makers who are selling into your local co-op. These are the bread makers who run a small bakery.
Okay, good. Let's pick that up when we come back. I guess that is the question for finishing up. Where do we go from here? Can we survive, or will we be faced with a future of government-guaranteed safe food? Think of it, folks. Does it make your mouth water right back? Well, the government is going to guarantee safe food for you and I. Just think of it. We'll be able to eat without fear. And guess what we'll be able to eat? That's the frightening part. It won't be very pretty, folks. It'll be brightly packaged, of course. They always come in beautiful packages, but it'll be made out of genetically engineered soybeans, and that soybeans will be fortified with Chinese-made vitamins because they're the only ones that make vitamins anymore. It'll be flavored with nano-grade goo of choice. It'll taste like anything we want it to taste like. And it'll be sterilized, as Mark Castle was starting to get to, with spent nuclear fuel. And, of course, it'll be colored green. They'll say it's green food, and it'll make us feel good. But it just doesn't wet my appetite in the least bit, and I bet it doesn't wet your appetite as well. So we have a few minutes left. Can we somehow survive this and still maintain our family agriculture, Mark?
Well, let's be proactive. We want to encourage your California listeners and your listeners around the country to call their United States Senator. The floor vote is imminent on Senate Bill 510. And tell them very strongly that you want to them that you want your representatives, your senators, to vote in favor of the Tester amendments. And that's something you can do tangibly. There are people doing that all around the country. Judith, is there anything else that you would recommend right now?
I think that is absolutely the core action right now. The reality is there's so much pressure from both the public and from the industry who wants the PR cover of this bill, that, you know, it's overwhelmingly likely that the food safety bill will pass. There's always a chance it could get derailed, but it's likely to pass. So the best thing we can do is to try to protect our local producers, try to protect the farmers and the food producers who are providing safe and healthy food, both, by getting the tester amendments into the bill.
So that's what we need to fight for, Fran?
Yeah, I agree with that. We need to encourage people to call on the tester amendment, and I also take a longer-term view, as I know both Mark and Judith do, which is it's so important, even though this thing will probably go through and may be a disaster, that we need to educate people more and more so that the votes come back to the people, the way they vote with it, the way we vote with our shopping budget every single week of our lives makes a huge difference in terms of what kind of food is going to be produced. And the more people are aware of the consumers, of what where their food comes from and what the consequences are of local, sustainable versus industrial agriculture, I think that's what's needed.
Education, education, education. And, you know, I do think people respond to, you know, being taught about their food. I think that especially we city people who have grown away from the source of our food, when we no longer have any, you know, control over where that food comes from. And I think, you know, though we eat from those brightly packaged meals that are come on the supermarket shelves, that that way down deep inside we're concerned about what we eat, and we want to eat the best, and since we want to eat the best, we better really do everything we can to protect our local farmers and the food that they grow for us. Folks, this has been The Food Chain. Michael Olson with Mark Castell, the Cornucopia Institute, Judith McGrary, Farm and Ranch Freedom Alliance, and Fran Shaw out there in Cleveland, Ohio. So thank you all for joining us today. Really appreciate it. We want you to go out and remember when you go shopping that cheap food isn't. Thank you all so much. And thank you, Mark, Fran, and Judith.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Bye, Michael.
Bye-bye.
Bye now. Thank you.
You've been listening to the award-winning Food Chain Show with Michael Olson. If your friends missed the show today, tell them to log on to the radio page at www.metrofarm.com for a listen. Now go out and find some food with a farmer's face on it and live.